So it turns out that one of the continuing themes of this program has been Galbraith, Sweetheart, Turbulence, which I guess you and I can see whether we're doing the whole thing together. And so we're going to continue our series. Elliot Potter is visiting, visiting next week from the Institute. I'm just going to talk about collision with famine.
So indeed, I'm going to talk about basically the damping of MHD turbulence in collisionless plasmas. And in particular, this is somewhat of a problem where what you get out in terms of the dissipation and the implications of the dissipation depend on what you put in for the turbulent cascade. And so I'm going to put in what I believe, which is the Galbraith-Sweetheart cascade, which I'll review. So there are a number of applications, of course, of dissipation of collisionless dissipation of turbulence. Generally, there's the whole problem of particle heating, particle acceleration in collisionless plasmas. The application that I have in mind, which I'll talk about in the most detail, is a particular class of collisionless accretion flows, where this issue of which particles get heated by turbulence is important. I'll review that very briefly. I think many of you were at my earlier talk, but I'll review that very briefly. This problem is also, of course, important in other contexts, solar corona, thin disk corona. I put a question mark here because these are highly magnetized plasmas where it's not as obvious that the cascade I'm going to be talking about is relevant. The application here is for what is at least can crudely be considered an incompressible plasma. And so this cascade of Galbraith-Sweetheart is more applicable. The other application I'll very, very briefly touch on is the question of what sets the inner scale of turbulence in the interstellar medium if it's highly ionized. And I understand actually from talking to Ellen that probably in many circumstances, frictional collisional damping is quite dominant. So it's not clear that one ever gets to the small scale set by collisionless damping. But so I hope people ask a lot of questions because this is, I'm not sure how much I have to say otherwise. So just very briefly, the accretion flow problem I'm interested in is an accretion flow that is collisionless in the sense that the time scale for electrons and protons to exchange energy by Coulomb collisions is longer than it takes the time scale for the gas to accrete. And so this means that essentially the electrons and protons can be thermally decoupled, assuming there's no other energy exchange mechanism. And one gets a two-temperature plasma. Protons, it turns out, are generally much hotter than the electrons. And the reason that the issue of the heating of protons versus electrons is important is because what you'd expect to see from this kind of accretion flow model depends on how much energy gets to the electrons. The electrons are the particle species that radiate, and so the question of whether the turbulence puts its energy in the electrons or the protons determines what you end up seeing in terms of radiation. So I'll spend some time, in addition to just talking about the actual dissipation mechanisms that are relevant, the more specific question of where that energy goes. Is it the protons or the electrons that are relevant in terms of doing the dissipation? So, this is a very classic problem. You have some cascade of turbulence. You inject energy on large scales, small wave vectors. On these large scales, it's not dissipated, so the energy undergoes a cascade, nonlinear cascade, to small scales, and on small scales, dissipation mechanisms become important. So to answer, of course, the questions of how is the energy dissipated, does it go into the electrons and the protons, there's kind of two key questions. One is you need to know the details of this nonlinear cascade to small scales, because the details of the cascade determine what kinds of dissipation mechanisms are important. Also, of course, you need to know generally, what kinds of dissipation mechanisms are relevant. I'm interested in a collisionless plasma. So, you know, collisional effects like resistivity, viscosity aren't important. So the particular turbulent cascade I'm going to discuss is basically the strong cascade of Goldreich and Sridhar. So I'll review this a little bit. I mean, to step back one step, in hydrodynamic turbulence, no magnetic fields around at all. Then on small scales, one believes that the turbulence is isotropic. There's nothing to pick out any direction in the plasma. And this isn't the case when you have a large-scale magnetic field. On small scales, the motions, you know, the fluctuations, small-scale Alfvén waves, fluctuations in velocity and magnetic field are strongly affected by the presence of a large mean magnetic field in the plasma. And so it's not a priori obvious whether you'd have an isotropic or an anisotropic cascade.
Are you thinking there of a situation in which the large-scale magnetic field is stronger than the small-scale fluctuations in the magnetic field?
Yes, that's right.
Well,
that certainly turns out self-consistently in the cascade. If you put energy in on large scales, it's not dissipated. It just gets transferred to smaller scales. The energy density is negligible on small scales. It all resides in the large scale.
The magnetic energy.
The magnetic, yeah, that's right.
Would you agree with the distinction between a large-scale magnetic field, which has a wave number, which is smaller than that of the input turbulence, and on the other hand, the magnetic field associated with the input speed? Because I think your arguments go through either way, because in either case, the magnetic field at a small scale
right.
is basically either of the largest entities.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. It's basically on very small scales, everything on large scales is just some time independent mean magnetic field. That's right.
And can I follow up on Keith's question?
Yes.
He's been here, but it needs to be stronger. What about the case when it's actually comparable? And the fluctuations are comparable, like they are in the galaxy.
So the energy density in very small scale magnetic field fluctuations is comparable to that. In the largest scale, I don't think.
And what I mean is that the fluctuations are comparable, that the energy in the fluctuations, and that means that
the energy, that's not the relevant issue. The issue is that the magnetic field perturbations, you know, the delta B over B is very small on small scales. And that means that one really does have, you know, the turbulent dynamics on small scales is dominated by the larger.
So,
the energy density in fluctuations is certainly comparable to the mean energy density. I agree, but on small scales, it's still the case that delta B over B is very small.
Okay, so, in other words, you would say the GS regime does apply to the case of galaxies where the two are comparable?
Yes, I would say so.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
But on a scale much larger than the.
I mean, the energy
on small scales. On small scales.
Delta B squared.
Yeah. So there's very little energy on small scales. That's right.
It's energy per unit.
Energy.
Number.
Yeah.
It's not total energy.
Yeah, that's right. So you have, on large scales, you have a mean field and you have a delta B of order B. And on small scales, you have delta B much less than B. So I agree. I think this is a guess. Obviously, I'm not sure. But I think that the GS cascade should apply also to the case where delta B is of order B on large scales.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you're going to say more about this, right?
More about
the similarities of that.
I'll go through, yeah. So the upshot of this particular turbulent cascade is that on small scales, basically the energy resides in perturbations which have wave vectors perpendicular to the magnetic field much larger than wave vectors parallel to the magnetic field. So the energy is cascading almost entirely perpendicular to the magnetic field. Not as much energy is cascading parallel to the magnetic field. And the particular regime in wave vector space where the energy resides is set by a simple requirement that the nonlinear time scale of the turbulence be comparable to the linear time scale. So on any scale, any wave vector scale in the plasma. There's a linear time scale associated with basically the Alfvén frequency. That's just set by the parallel wave vector. And there's a nonlinear time scale, or the time scale on which energy gets transferred to smaller scales, which is set by basically the perpendicular wave vector. And the requirement that these two time scales be comparable picks out this anisotropic cascade, where most of the energy resides in wave vectors. Perpendicular wave vector is much bigger than parallel wave vector.
And
so, okay, so good. So the key question is, why would you ever expect it to get to this situation? And this is really the most powerful part of the argument, I think, is what they showed is that if the energy, imagine you have an isotropic injection of energy, or you have some energy in a different part of wave vector space up here. In this part of wave vector space, the nonlinear frequency is much less than the linear frequency. K parallel is much larger than it is here. That means that basically a given mode exists for many, many mode period before it decays. In this limit, one can actually use perturbation theory and try to rigorously analyze what the turbulent cascade is. And the upshot of their arguments is that when one is in the weak turbulence regime, the energy always cascades exactly perpendicular to the magnetic field. There's no parallel cascade at all. So wherever you start out in wave vector space, this is the argument, the energy is going to flow such that it approaches this critical balance where the nonlinear and linear time scales are comparable. But I mean, if one didn't have this argument, this would be much less satisfying. So that's the argument. Weak turbulence, when the nonlinear time scale is much longer than the linear time scale, cascades in such a way that it becomes more and more nonlinear, and you approach this balance of time scales. Analyzing this limit with any rigor is, of course, very difficult. This is, you know, in some ways analogous to fluid turbulence, hydrodynamic turbulence, where it's quite difficult to analyze it rigorously.
What would be an example where things are reversed?
Oh, if I put in, you mean where things are an actual example?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, one can inject energy such that it's in this regime.
I understand.
Okay.
Can you give an example when you would this time reversed?
Let's see.
When nonlinear would be more rapid.
When nonlinear would be more rapid than linear.
Two-dimensional interchange data. So if you just had interchanges, that would be an example. No, that's stable.
Yeah, if you have delta B, but that would get dissipated. Well, if you force it. No, that's right. Yeah.
Please ask one more thing.
Sure.
Because you're thinking of a situation in which kinetic energy is injected at some scale.
For instance, in the accretion flow problem, you have an MHD instability, so it's not just pure kinetic energy. This is not just a dynamo problem where you have kinetic energy and you have to generate the magnetic field. But
well, that's a legendary problem you are considering in that case.
So certainly my interest is most in the accretion flow problem. That's right. But
I think the issue at the moment is this ordinary MHD turbulence on off. But in the presence of our scale field.
Yes. That's right.
So then there is some source of energy.
Yes.
Okay, and generating kinetic energy. The question is what is the relative magnitude of that kinetic energy,
yes,
and the energy of the large-scale field?
Presumably, in many cases of interest, they're comparable.
It makes a big difference. I mean, if the large-scale magnetic field were very weak, for example.
Right. No, one is not. I don't think one is in the regime where the large-scale magnetic field is weak. Certainly for the problems I'm interested in, I think one's in the regime where
they're comparable, or
the fluctuation. How do I? I don't. Well, I mean, I guess. Are you asking the question if I have some turbulent accretion flow, I formally define a mean magnetic field?
Well,
is that much less than the fluctuation?
Problem you're considering.
You tell us what the input is, and then we can begin to understand.
So the problem I really want to consider is just the dissipation on very small scales.
Yes.
And so I think that the details in many cases of what happens on large scales is not so crucial, you know, so long as, say, one is roughly in this incompressible limit, so that the energy is roughly following this cascade.
I think it's absolutely crucial. If the large-scale magnetic field is very weak, then it's going to get tangled up on all scales by the turbulence, whatever turbulence input you have.
Yes.
On the other hand, if the magnetic field on large scales is very strong,
no, one is in. So, I mean, from the point of view of, you know, the beta, I'm interested in case of beta order 1 or 5 or something like
that's,
that.
That's important that we know that. Yes. That's what you're
okay, saying. No, sure. Sorry. Together.
I have a bit of a thing about that.
Oh, okay.
So, how would the turbulence look like? If you have one particular direction of the large scale field, can you give a sketch maybe on the blackboard? Of something that you would expect. Maybe we can discuss it afterwards with some real examples. I mean, we have simulations, of course.
Yes.
So there's a large scale field. Maybe we can look at that later on.
Yeah, I mean, really what I'm...
No, that's what Jason's been working on.
Right.
Okay, so maybe...
I'm really mostly interested in the dissipation on very small scales. I'm not an expert at all on what the large scale magnetic field.
We'll have further discussion next week at length on the cascade. So Paul will be back in
the conference. Yes.
Final question.
Sure.
Is it obvious that the GS cascade applies to a rotating shear file?
Yes.
I don't know that it's, I mean, again, on small scales, that's unimportant. So these are all the questions of, on small scales, that's completely unimportant. So there's still the thorny question of, right, you're really injecting energy on very large scales where all of this matters. Maybe that affects the details of whether things become anisotropic on small scales. But it seems to me that, you know, once you go to very small scales, the Coriolis, you know, all the rotational effects are important. One can just go back to the standard analysis that they did. The energy flows this way, and you end up, you know, with this particular cascade.
Sorry, just for clarification.
Sure.
Is it a best guess, or can you show me the physically that it's been important?
I have not shown it explicitly, no. But it's the same question. I mean, does the fact that there's a density inhomogeneity matter on small scales? No, because you're interested in fluctuations which are much smaller than the characteristic scale. But the, you know, the kind of Doppler shift across the wavelength is totally negligible. Yeah. It's not.
I think there have been no verifications so far that
it becomes isotropic
on small scales, the shear flow.
That it becomes isotropic?
Yeah, I think there's no evidence for that so far. Although I would agree, I would expect that, but I think, if I'm not mistaken, nobody has actually seen that.
I think that's true, but certainly on small enough scale, you don't see the galactic rotation.
Yeah.
Or the rotation of the disk, or whatever it is.
Well, but you know, differential rotation can also be a feeder
That's large scale.
Well, the cascade is done before. Yeah, they're inherited to some kind of cascade. Yeah, I mean, even if it's true, that probably really does mean that spherical takes quite a long way to go along the cascade until it really becomes isotropic. I mean, because I think.
Or anisotropic is.
On shear flows, just hydrodynamic shear flows, again, they don't see that. And they have a resolution of 256 cubed. And if that is not sufficient, I mean, what do you need then?
To be totally honest, you know, my approach was that I'm interested in what happens on small scales where it seems to me most of these effects are not important, then you really are in the fairly simple problem of something like a mean magnetic field with fluctuations, and then you have this weak cascade which approaches the strong. But so this may be slightly dangerous, but I'm going to show simulations that Jason gave me which show something like this, though it's probably better to have discussion of this at another time if people have a lot of questions. But, you know, a couple caveats. These are incompressible simulations, so this doesn't get into the issue of, well, what if you introduce compressibility? What happens? But this is basically a plot of the ratio of this linear frequency to nonlinear frequency as a function of perpendicular scale, and it's roughly constant, which is consistent with the analytical arguments. And also quite interesting, this is a plot of the kind of two-dimensional power spectrum. Power spectrum is a function of k-perp and k-parallel. So basically, at different perpendicular wave vectors, S is just a dimensionless wave vector. So as a function of the parallel wave vector, four different perpendicular wave vectors. And so if you take, you know, k-perp of 20, you see that the power is roughly constant for small k-parallel, and then it's cutting off very strongly, roughly exponentially, above about k-parallel of order unity. So this is indeed highly anisotropic. All of the energy at a given k-perp is residing at very small k-parallel. That's what? Log. Yeah. Yes. that's good.
But is it log-log or log-linear?
It's log-log. Yeah, it's log log.
So it's power log, not exponential, is what you're saying. It's exponential outside of the cone.
Yeah. So, in fact, for the whole issue of the dissipation, what matters is, you know, a lot of what really matters is this property of the cascade. The fact that one is in a regime where the perpendicular wave vector is much bigger than the parallel wave vector. And I'll come back to this diagram some, but the reason is you can just look at kind of the relevant frequencies in this problem. And the fact that the energy is cascading mostly along the perpendicular and not the parallel direction means that the frequency of the turbulence is always well below the proton cyclotron frequency. And this is very important. In fact, in almost all astrophysical discussions of the dissipation of alphanic turbulence, the cyclotron resonance is invoked. So it is assumed that the energy is basically cascading in frequency to reach frequencies of order the proton cyclotron frequency. And if this anisotropic cascade is correct, then that's not the case, that the energy, in fact, cascades maintaining a very low frequency. So quantitatively, if you reach a perpendicular length scale of order the proton Larmor radius, which is relevant, as you'll see, then the frequency is smaller than the proton cyclotron frequency by basically the ratio of the Larmor radius to the outer scale of the turbulence to the one-third power. And this can be 9, 10, 12 orders of magnitude, so that even the third power still leaves you with frequencies which are below the proton cyclotron frequency by many, many orders of magnitude. And the reason that this is important is because of how waves get damped in a collisionless plasma. So basically, collisionless dissipation is a wave-particle resonance. The resonance condition is very simple. This is the frequency of a mode. Omega here is the cyclotron frequency. N is some integer. K is, again, k-parallel, the wave vector along the field, the mean field. V-parallel is the velocity of the particle along the mean field. And this resonance condition just says if you Doppler shift into a frame moving with the particle along the mean magnetic field, then you have a resonance between particles and waves if that frequency is some integer multiple of the cyclotron frequency. In that case, as the particle goes around and around the magnetic field line, it's phase coherent with the wave. Thanks. And so the real importance of the low frequency of the Goldreich-Sweetheart cascade is that it restricts one to basically this n equals zero resonance, the Landau or the Chernyankov resonance, in which the resonance is basically that the speed of the wave, the phase speed of the wave, equals the speed of the particle. So this is the relevant resonance at which waves couple the particles in this cascade. In fact, there are two different actual physical ways that the wave can lose energy to the particle. Can lose energy to the particles. The one that's probably most familiar to everybody is Landau damping. If you have a parallel electric field perturbation associated with a wave, then that couples to the charge of a particle, and the wave can get damped. There's an analogous process in which you have a parallel magnetic field perturbation, basically a compressive magnetic field perturbation, and that interacts with the magnetic moment of a particle and leads to dissipation of the wave. The magnetic moment here is conserved because we're well below the proton cyclotron frequency, so this is an adiabatic invariant. And really this process, which is called transit time damping or magnetic Landau damping, is really just a collisionless version of Fermi acceleration. So you have compressive magnetic field perturbations associated with a wave, which are acting like the magnetic mirrors in Fermi's picture and bouncing particles around. And the energy then gets transferred from the wave to the particle.
Does this happen in compressibility?
I'm sorry, what?
If the mode is incompressible, do you get transit time damping?
You get very strong, right, transit time damping.
If the wave is incompressible?
In the limit beta goes to infinity, you get... No. Do you get... No, Landau damping certainly has to be compressible. I don't think this has to be compressible. Right? This damping mechanism is present even in the limit as beta goes to infinity. It gets rid of it's why one is interested in Alphane turbulence, not
beta zero.
I have to define beta. Gas pressure over magnetic pressure. So for large beta, Landau damping is unimportant because you're basically incompressible. Parallel electric field perturbations are associated with density fluctuations.
So you need to create magnetic force.
Yeah, you need to create magnetic force.
Yeah, you can do that in
compressibility. Yeah, you can have the perpendicular compressibility bounced by the parallel.
Yeah.
You can do it in pseudo.
Yeah. Yeah. So one thing that's important is that in the MHD limit, so if you're at wavelengths much larger than the proton Larmor radius. So one is somewhere here in the cascade. Then Alphane waves have no parallel electric or parallel magnetic field perturbation. And so this is why one actually talks about in Alphanic turbulence a cascade that can reach very small scales in a collisionless plasma. Because all of these dissipation mechanisms only set in when you start to get kinetic theory or when you start to get significant modifications to the MHD mode. And that only happens when you approach the proton Larmor radius.
So, the transit time damping doesn't work on the Alphane wave.
It does work on the Alphane wave as it approaches the proton Larmor radius. Because as the Alphane wave approaches the proton Larmor radius, it develops a parallel magnetic field perturbation. Or a parallel electric, depending on the kind of plasma one's in. So there's one other. Yes. Yes. Where in the beta goes to infinity limit, this is all that survives.
But it's a very high beta.
Yeah, that's right. So these are really the two damping mechanisms that are relevant in these low-frequency turbulent cascades in collisionless plasmas. So it's pretty straightforward and quite interesting to look at the question of which particles get heated by these two processes. And this is slightly messy, but it's actually pretty easy. So you can just ask, what is the ratio of the proton heating rate to the electron heating rate for either of these mechanisms? And it just depends on the ratio of three quantities. One is the mass ratio. Electrons are generally easier to heat than protons. For the case of Landau damping, it depends on the charge ratio, because this is a coupling of an electric field to the charge of the particle. So this is unity for electrons and protons. And then the last thing it depends on is how many resonant particles there are. This is a resonant interaction, so if there are more resonant electrons or resonant protons, those are more easily damped. For these kinds of collisionless mechanisms, the resonant number of resonant particles just depends on the derivative of the distribution function at the speed of the wave, at the phase speed of the wave. And so the easiest thing to see is that if you take a situation in which in a highly two-temperature plasma, which is what I'm interested in for the accretion flow problem, then the thermal speed of the electrons can be comparable to the thermal speed of the protons. You have an equal number of resonant protons and electrons. So in Landau damping, all of the energy goes into the electrons, not the protons, by basically the mass ratio, the mass of the electrons to the mass of the protons. And in the magnetic version of Landau damping, one has the opposite result. And the reason is that everything is the same, except you replace the wave-particle coupling isn't through the charge, it's through the magnetic moment. If the protons are much hotter than the electrons, they have a much larger magnetic moment than the electrons do. So in the magnetic version of Landau damping, it's the protons that couple most strongly to the waves, not the electrons. So back to this question of which mechanism is relevant, Landau damping or transit time damping, in what kinds of plasma. So the relevant thing turns out to be here the beta, the gas pressure to the magnetic pressure. And basically, in the kinds of accretion flows I'm interested in, the gas pressure is going to be larger than the magnetic pressure, that, or comparable to the magnetic pressure. Something similar is true in the interstellar medium. The inequality is reversed in, say, the solar corona. And in the limit of large beta, where things are relatively incompressible, you have no density fluctuations. You have no parallel electric field perturbations. So Landau damping is unimportant in this limit. So in the beta bigger than one limit, it's the magnetic fluctuations which are most important for damping the waves. And in the opposite limit, in the small beta limit, say the corona limit, then it's actually Landau damping which is most important for damping the waves.
Isn't it because the Alphane waves are traveling faster than the protons? The protons can't.
No, this actually just has to do with whether the Alphane wave has, as it approaches the proton Larmor radius, a parallel electric or a parallel magnetic field perturbation. What you said also comes in.
Oh.
That's
right.
So, a little bit, the basic argument is that I don't think it's important because the cascade to small scales happens on a time scale of order the linear mode frequency.
But you do put energy into the ions.
Right. No. I agree. But that's a higher order effect, right? So I think it's not important because the cascade is happening so efficiently.
On small scale.
Yeah, so that's the... So the remaining thing to do is to go and calculate. So this tells you kind of, depending on what plasma you're in, which dissipation mechanism is important. The earlier simple analytic scalings told one whether it was going into the electrons or protons. The really remaining relevant question is how strong is the dissipation? So one can just go and...
On this Landau damping, could you say how fast the electrons are compared to phase velocity?
So...
Is it only the very small electrons which are picking up the energy?
Well, In the accretion flow problem, the temperature ratio can be so high that the thermal speeds are comparable. So you're actually resonating with the bulk of the distribution for both protons and the electrons. But that depends, again, on the problem one's interested in solving.
Okay, so the electrons are going to
yeah, That's right. Exactly. So this is just the end result of a kinetic theory calculation of the dissipation. So this is a plot of the dissipation rate in units of the mode period as a function of the perpendicular wave vector relative to the Larmor radius of the protons. And basically, in this regime, one has Alphane waves kind of in the MHD limit, and in this regime, things are weakly damped. Right? This is, the damping falls off very strongly, and the dissipation is unimportant in this regime. As you approach the proton Larmor radius, dissipation starts to get more important. And in particular, the dissipation increases as you decrease the magnetic field strength of the plasma. This is, again, easy to understand. If the magnetic field is weaker, the Larmor radius of the protons is bigger, so effectively the magnetic moment is bigger, so you couple more strongly to the magnetic field perturbations. So as the beta increases, the dissipation by the protons becomes more important. And you'll notice that there's a peak in the dissipation at a length scale of order of the proton Larmor radius, and then the dissipation drops off pretty strongly. And this is due to an effect known as Larmor circle averaging. So what one has, let's just go back to this diagram. So you have this you have a wave which has a wavelength perpendicular to the magnetic field much smaller than the proton Larmor radius, but a frequency less than the proton cyclotron frequency. I think it's on everything. So what basically happens in this limit is that in the course of a single mode period, by this inequality, a proton undergoes many, many cyclotron orbits. But in so doing, because of this inequality, it sees a wave that has a wavelength much smaller than its Larmor radius. And so the effects of the wave on the particle completely average out. So once you get into this regime where the wave frequency is smaller than the proton cyclotron frequency, but the wave length is shorter than the Larmor radius, the protons essentially don't couple at all anymore to the waves. And in fact, the complete character of the waves change. These are no longer Alphane waves. They're what's called a Whistler mode. And so one can ask, well, what happens to any energy that gets past the scale of order of the proton Larmor radius? The protons don't dissipate the energy anymore. Instead, the energy continues to small scales where it's eventually dissipated by the electrons by Landau damping. So the real relevant thing here is...
Then Alphane waves cut off at the cyclotron
frequency. Right, so that's why I said it continues as Whistler.
But that's the magnetosonic range.
That's...
If you wasn't excited.
No. The dispersion relation evolves continuously here.
Right. At the sound branch goes into the Whistler, and the other one cuts off. And if you're very not excited, magnetosonic, would you excite the Whistler?
In this parameter regime, at low frequencies and large perpendicular wave vectors, and if beta is not too large, so say it's 100, which is certainly the practical case of interest, then the Alphane wave dispersion relation evolves continuously into the Whistler dispersion. So as beta goes to infinity, then you're right. Then the Alphane wave completely cuts off. But that's not what's of interest. I mean, practically, we're interested in the beta of 10, 100, 1. It's not exactly clear. So one of the interesting things that came out of all of this is that for strongly magnetized, well, what I'm calling strongly magnetized, beta of order unity, the dissipation rate is actually rather weak. So the dissipation time is much longer than the mode period in this regime. And the reason that that's important is, of course, is the energy is cascading on a time scale comparable to the mode period. That's the feature of the strong cascade. So that means as energy is flowing here in wave vector space, this dissipation is completely unimportant.
Sorry, I didn't get that.
Yes. So as the energy is cascading in this direction in wave vector space, it basically doesn't see this dissipation. This dissipation occurs on too long a time scale. The energy continues to cascade to small scales where it's finally dissipated by the electrons. So the end result is that whether the energy is dissipated into the protons or into the electrons depends on the magnetic field strength. If the magnetic field is relatively close to equipartition, then the energy goes into the electrons because it cascades to small scales where the protons are unimportant. If the magnetic field is relatively weak, then the energy goes into the protons because it's dissipated on scales of order of the Larmor radius. And one can actually, you know, try to make a best estimate of this by just, you know, integrating the energy flux, taking into account the dissipation rate as a function of wave vector, including the proton dissipation, the electron dissipation, seeing where does the energy go. This is, and what one gets out is something like this. This is a plot of how much energy goes into the electrons as a function of the magnetic field strength. And unfortunately, things turn out to depend, because the energy, how much energy gets dissipated goes exponentially with the dissipation rate. Things depend exponentially on a number that you don't know very well. And that number is basically what's the nonlinear time scale of the turbulence.
Didn't the electron ion
No, so certainly in the accretion flow problem that I was interested in when I did these calculations, Coulomb collisions are totally unimportant.
But if you take 100 and raise it to the 3 power, that will overwhelm the square root of mass.
This just sets the ratio. What matters is the absolute temperature. So if the temperatures are 10 to the 10, 10 to the 11 Kelvin, So what things, you know, the details of whether or not one is in the regime of electron heating or proton heating depend very sensitively on something you don't know very well, which is what exactly is the ratio of the cascade time to the dissipation time, or the cascade time to the nonlinear time.
I'm sorry.
No, sure.
You were in a MHC limit to create this cascade, where we let that ion collision.
No, so the, right, I mean, the MHD limit is presumably justified by the magnetic field. So that's the... It's collisionless, but, you know, MHD can describe the, you know, the large-scale properties of the fluid, not the properties like the dissipation. It's not entirely clear, for instance, that the whole issue of energy exchange by Coulomb collisions is relevant if there are other mechanisms.
No,
because you're dealing with a collisionless plasma.
The most along the field is no longer MHC, though.
The motion along the field, right.
You still perform the cascade in that case.
I don't know. That's the assumption. That's right. No, I don't think anybody's done the collisionless simulation yet.
I have a question.
Sure.
When you get below the proton scale.
Yes.
Proton anomaly.
Yes. The cascade changes. No, it's
whistle.
The cascade.
About the same as electron.
Yes.
Can you imagine the protons to be sort of frozen and electrons are carrying both the velocity as well as the current?
Yes.
Then the three-wave cascade.
That's right.
Whistler,
I agree.
Which is weak.
Yes, I agree. So it is not at all obvious what the cascade is going to do once it reaches below the scale of the proton Larmor radius. I agree. Because you have a weak cascade which does not force you to stay. I mean, there's an analog of your strong cascade where the linear time is comparable to the nonlinear time. But unlike in, you know, you can formally write down what do you get if you equate the linear to the nonlinear time?
For Whistlers.
For Whistlers.
No,
but the problem is that the weak cascade doesn't force you to go in that regime.
But you are
injecting energy into what is essentially a strong Whistler turbulence. So it isn't clear. Now, I don't think it matters at all for this issue of dissipation because one is at such low frequencies that the energy, the only worry would be that somehow the energy suddenly gets transferred all the way up to the proton cyclotron frequency. So if the cascade were to do something like that, when it hit the proton Larmor radius scale, then these dissipation mechanisms would not be the important one.
Is there something like a song whistler turbulence?
Yeah, there is. The ratio of time scales, longitudinal and transverse time scales, is still preserved there. The only thing that changes is to change the dispersion relation.
Yeah.
So you get the same k to the minus 5/3 scaling, but the transverse cascade.
Well, I'm not sure that's right, because Sridhar's right. There's a weak cascade. There's a weak cascade of. Yeah, exactly.
So we assume that's entropy there, though.
Yes, that is right.
Yeah.
Electrons collisionless? Tremendous collision rates with a factor of 100.
The electrons are they're completely collisionless. For the problem that I'm there at a million, at 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10 Kelvin. So I think the answer is it's not at all clear what happens. There is an analog of the strong cascade where you're injecting energy into the whistlers, but there's also a weak cascade, and the weak cascade doesn't force you into a strong cascade, unlike a now Fein wave case. So it isn't clear what happens.
But it is sort of crucially important how fast you move through this region of ion damping and into the electron.
Yes.
That's right.
So the ion damping does cut off very strongly as you go to, as you go above the below the Larmor radius.
Do you know the density as you're talking about?
Yeah, say 10 to the 8 particles per centimeter cubed. So you have 10 to the 8 particles per centimeter cubed, 10 to the 11 k protons, and 10 to the 9 k electrons. So this is completely collisionless relative to the relevant time scale in the problem.
10 to the 9 Kelvin.
Yeah, which is it's completely collisionless for relevant to the time scale, which is of interest, which is the time scale on which gas flows in an accretion flow. So.
C is 3.
C is 3 now. It is. Okay. So it changed. It was 6.
It's the same as dogs was.
It is? You sure there's not a definition of 2?
Let's compare our definitions.
From the fact that this is an energy time scale is relevant? I'm sure it's, yeah. So the implication then is for this issue of you have a collisionless accretion flow, does the energy go into the protons or the electrons? The issue is, well, how strong is the magnetic field? And of course, it's even a more complicated problem than that, in fact, because you expect you'll have localized regions maybe where the magnetic field is strong, you have some dissipation there, some regions where it's weak, you have some dissipation there. It's unclear, I think, what the end result of that is. And it's particularly unclear, right, when one thinks that turbulence in the accretion flow generates an equipartition magnetic field, it's very unclear whether or not that means beta of 1, beta of 10, it could even be beta of 100, and I think this is a question that will only really be addressed through MHD simulations. Well, the question is, well, you want to know what is, this is saying that, but this is saying that the dissipation mechanisms depend on how basically the ratio, you know, some dimensionless ratio of the temperature to the magnetic field strength. So that.
So you weren't saying the waves.
Right. That's not what's relevant for the dissipation. That's wrong.
Is it true that all of this results in either the electrons or the protons being heated and therefore determining beta? Is that correct?
That's not clear.
What determines beta?
Well, presumably beta is determined by the nonlinear saturation of something like the Balbus-Hawley instability. And it's not clear that depends on how much energy on small scales goes into protons or electrons.
So isn't
the
energy in the way is tiny compared to the beta anyway. So if you just take the waves, you increase beta.
No,
it's not. No.
Scale.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's not at all clear to me that this is relevant for the issue of saturation. No, this is... Yes, this does give you, right, this is the heating and pure compression. That's right.
So beta is the ratio of this number to the magnetic field, right?
So, but the point is that in, there's a certain amount of energy which is dissipated into electrons or protons,
right?
Right? The total amount of energy is independent of the details of whether that energy goes into protons or electrons.
Right.
So what sets the saturation level of the magnetic field is, I think, independent of the issue of where does the energy go. That's not.
If you put the energy into electrons, then you radiate it, and the magnetic field is basically an
equipartition.
Sure.
So this is, if you assume that all of the energy goes into the electrons, there is no heating of protons whatsoever, then I agree that's important. Then it's an issue. But of course, you know, you have a myriad of other mechanisms which are, you know, can potentially heat both species. So no, sorry, that's right. In the limit where you're putting all of the energy into the electrons, then it becomes relevant. That's right.
And also, there's other issue that some of the energy goes into the shear octane race
right.
that you're describing, and some of the energy yes. at large scales goes into the other.
Right. So the slow mode basically is dissipated on large scales. It has a compressive magnetic field perturbation independent of wavelength. And so it's dissipated on very large scales, basically where the energy is injected. I agree.
And doesn't that go to
so that all goes into the protons. That's right. So the that's right.
Yeah. Let me ask you a related question.
Yes.
You said under certain conditions that the electrons get more dissipation.
Yes. Yes.
So you also have the ions 100 times as high as the electrons.
Right.
So
it is consistent because so one can go through the calculation with different temperature ratios, but it's consistent primarily because the temperature ratio is set more by the fact that the electrons radiate so efficiently. So the point is you put a bunch more energy into the electrons, they radiate it away without changing their temperature all that much. So
that's ion heating is sufficient to maintain them.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So just to end on a completely unrelated issue, forget about two temperatures or anything like that. Just ask the question, let's say we have a one temperature plasma in the interstellar medium. Where is the energy dissipated if collisional processes are completely unimportant? So this shows the dissipation rate as a function of mode period, as a function again of some combination of wave vector and Larmor radius for just a one temperature beta equals one plasma. And so one has the same thing that on scales of order the proton Larmor radius, the dissipation can be weak relative to the mode period. In a one temperature plasma, as you go to smaller scales, however, the dissipation, this is now pure electron dissipation, it increases monotonically. And if one just goes through and asks, on what scale is the energy dissipated, say, if you have a highly ionized ISM and the cascade does get all the way to small scales, the answer is that it will always be dissipated on length scales comparable to the proton Larmor radius, never much less than of order the Larmor radius divided by 10. And in fact, if beta is, say, 10 or 100, then in fact the energy will be dissipated on a length scale of order the proton Larmor radius. This is relevant for scintillation, for example.
And that's just a consequence of the mass ratio of protons to electrons?
What is that? Sorry.
The fact that it doesn't get much below the
The fact that it doesn't get go down? You mean that the dissipation never gets below this? Or I'm not sure what you were referring to.
Right, so it comes up above that.
Okay. All right, so that's. Okay, that's it. So the conclusion is that basically in terms of where does the energy go, protons or electrons, in a weak magnetic field plasma, the protons get heated in a strong reason, actually in either a order unity beta or a much less than one beta, the electrons get heated by this kind of low frequency cascade. That's the one conclusion. That's, you know, the primary upshot, I would say. Okay, thanks. Yes. Yes. So you basically, you pump energy into the parallel, not into the perpendicular, because you're at low frequencies. And that is unstable by the ion cyclotron resonance, generating alphane waves at the cyclotron frequency, which can isotropize the distribution. That's right.
So you have a further source of shortwave length.
Exactly. No, you do, though. It's
kind of a way of making
it's not, I mean, I don't think the energy goes anywhere. I think all it does is isotropize the distribution. So it reaches some, you know, steady state level at which it's isotropizing the distribution function. It's not, I mean, I don't think we understand the cascade of ion cyclotron waves. So it's not clear if that energy, you know, cascades somewhere else in wave vectors.
Doesn't that contradict the anisotropic condition you needed to set up the GS?
No. Because these high frequency waves you excite won't couple at all to these low frequency waves. Yeah.
On the temperature ratio, you seem to always write TIs as 100 TeV.
Yes.
So if you start to heat the electrons,
yes,
they start to move too fast to heat, except the very slow ones, which would then flatten, quasi linear flattening.
So I agree.
Turn off. I mean, if you were just, if you were resonant with the electrons very close to zero,
right.
The FCB is so small that all you do is flatten it and then
but add a temperature ratio of about 100. That's where, I mean, you know, at a temperature ratio of 1,000, the thermal speeds are comparable. At a temperature ratio of 100, they differ by a factor of 3.
No, it's the square root of
it. Yeah.
Square root of T over N.
Yeah, so at a temperature ratio of 100, the thermal speeds differ by about a factor of 3. And so that's not a huge difference in number of resonant particles.
Oh, so you don't heat the electrons very much, you just radiate. You heat them.
Right?
Well,
is that? Well, it's really the alphane speed
that's
important.
Yes. No, I agree.
That's what, 5 times the electron thermal speed. I mean, if
right, but that's
speed, 5 times
sure.
That,
that's all in this. I agree.
It turns off because you're only heating the.
Well, the heating doesn't turn off. It goes down. That's right.
It's not the distribution. And then you no longer can heat it until collisions come in. I mean, you know, you just put a little bit of energy into the slow electrons, then the distribution is flat, then the Landau density goes away.
If the distribution just gets completely flat, then Landau damping does go away.
Flat,
I agree. But one is, I guess one is actually near the peak of the electron distribution function.
If you are there,
that's right.
When you flat, then
but this temperature ratio is set mostly by the radiative process, the fact that the
Landau density is the force on the
yes.
Flow.
No.
It drops to zero until the collisions reestablish it.
You have to do the quasi, yeah, or in this case, there would be no collisions at all, so that wouldn't do.
So the quasi-linear heating would be very small because all you need to do is flatten it, and that would be the end.
But I mean, if one is near the peak of the distribution function, it takes a lot of energy to flatten it.
You have to do it over a very tiny interval
in velocity. That's true.
If you're really near the peak.
If you're
not on the side,
yeah.
If you're really near the peak, it's very flat.
No, that's right. That's right. Yeah, I mean, one isn't.
Slightly more, and then, of course, the collisions will reestablish the slope and zero the collision force is zero the
But it also isn't clear, I mean, in this case, how. I mean, one of the things I brushed under the rug is that because you have a strong cascade, you don't exactly have pure resonant interactions. Like, there are large frequency shifts associated with the waves. It's actually not clear. You may be resonating with particles over a much broader range of velocities.
Wouldn't Russell's point be even more important for equal temperatures? Because then the alphane speed is such a tiny fraction
of the thermal speed.
So then you would think that might really adjust your result for the fraction of energy going to protons versus electrons, you were finding...
I mean, but this result about where the energy goes is actually set basically just by what is the dissipation rate at the Larmor radius.
But the dissipation rate...
So
if you're affected by quasi-linear flattening,
yes, that's right. Right. Not the electrons. Now we're talking about the protons.
Because it's easy to flatten the electrons.
We're talking about the protons. Because so, everything is set by the dissipation rate of the protons at the Larmor radius. That's what determines how much energy gets to small scales where it goes into electrons. So if you can completely flatten the distribution function and kill off all proton dissipation on the Larmor radius scale, then yet more energy goes into the electrons. I agree.
If you take the ion and heat it in sticks, then look what happens, how much gets siphoned off the electrons.
Yes.
It gets very small, the potential ratio is not extremely large.
But the... I'm not sure I agree, because right, once one gets below the proton Larmor radius scale, the protons simply don't couple at all to the waves. So the energy, I don't see, even if you're going to adjust the distribution function, flatten it some, weaken the dissipation rate of the electrons, the dissipation rate due to the protons is still orders of magnitude smaller.
But what it will change, Alex, is it will change how far below.
It'll change how far below. Yeah. That I agree.
I mean, if you that I agree. Electrons are not, there's no damage.
Good. Yes, that I agree.
But why do you lose the heating to the lambda density on the ion? It seems like you're away right at the largest slope of the ion distribution.
No, I wasn't. In fact, that was the point. I was saying I don't think you would. I don't think you will lose. No, I don't think you will lose.
I don't think you lose. I think you lose the electron heating if it comes up too close to the ion
temperature. Okay, yeah.